Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So you could just see $100,000, $600,000
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven, the radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking, And Master Ronnie saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarion. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarion took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarion, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
As the sun rises over the Arabian Sea on the coastal city of Mumbai, the day is beginning for the 10 million people who live in the crowded city slums. The Hegre family lives in the Kalava slum in this tiny 10 by 10 foot concrete room. The 60 neighbors who live on their small lane all share just four toilets and this small room for bathing. The Hegre's three daughters, six-year-old twins Anisha and Tanisha, and 12-year-old big sister Anchal, are up early getting ready for school. Their mother, Parvati, helps get the girls and her husband, Rajesh, out the door. After their dad drops the girls off at school, he heads to his job at a security company where he earns about $200 a month. Then Parvati cleans their house, makes lunch and dinner, and performs her daily prayers. Then the most important task of all, she collects the next day's supply of water. In this slum, water only flows during a two-hour window, just once a day.
I felt that you can't come to India without experiencing what we've all heard about the poverty. But I also wanted to frame that story in such a way that it represented the truth of the people. Anchal,
yeah.
I think this is so wonderful that you're giving me the tour guide. You speak English so well. So it wasn't just people living in slums, eating out of the trash piles and not having a place to defecate and all the stuff that comes with being extremely, extremely poor. But for me, every story is about the heart of the people. And so what is the heart of the people? How do you find a story that shows somebody who is living a life of sparseness, of poverty, but also still has the heart? Thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Great. All right, we're going here?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Showers of blessings. Oh, thank you.
Namaste.
Thank you, family. Thank you. I have to tell you, when I stepped in the door, I was thinking, okay, where is the house? Okay, where's the rest of the house? And then I realized I was already in it.
All right, everybody quiet, please.
Okay, I wanted to start off by just saying thank you for allowing me into your home. How long have you lived in this home?
Living for 33 years.
33 years?
Yes.
You don't look 33 years old, but you've lived here your whole life?
Yeah.
So your family was here before?
Yeah, my family is also here.
In this space?
Yes, this space.
And this is the entire space. The entire family lives and sleeps in this space.
Mm.
One, two, three, four, five of you sleep in this room.
In this room.
You eat in this room. Mm. You play in this room.
Mm.
You share family time together in this room, which is from here to here. The five of you.
Yeah.
Okay. This may be an obvious question, and I don't mean to be offensive, but does it ever feel crowded? Does it feel crowded?
No.
It doesn't feel crowded.
No, we just manage it. We have a habit of sleeping because we don't feel anything.
You don't feel anything?
Yeah.
And how do you do it? I mean, how do you physically do it?
I sleep in that corner.
Where I am right now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she sleeps over here, my mother over here, my another sister over here, and my father over here.
Okay. All right. Would you say this is... is this a hard life? Is it difficult?
Yes, ma'am.
It is.
Yeah.
And tell me what's the most difficult thing about it.
Difficult work, tell us that mother work aayegi, maja family illa, he karega.
Means he has a problem that he cannot manage his salary enough for four people. Yeah.
This was an arranged marriage, right?
Yeah.
Was it arranged marriage?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it turn into a love marriage?
After 1 year, I love it.
After 1 year, you love it. Is he a good partner?
Yeah, very good partner.
Good partner.
Yeah.
Do you have a good life with him?
Yeah, very nice life.
I recently renovated this 100 square foot building into a cozy tiny home, and in this video I'll show you around and break down the cost along the way. You enter the property from the side because the building is located in my garden, detached from the main house here in the east of England. I've lived in the house for 4 years, but it's currently undergoing some major renovations, so the tiny house gives me somewhere to live in the meantime. When the house is finished, I'll be renting it out, so this tiny space will serve as storage for my stuff, as I'll be moving away for a while. The extra tall fence can make the space feel darker, but will provide privacy to the tenants if ever I need to come and collect something. Now, you enter the tiny home via this lobby, which feels surprisingly spacious thanks to the wall-to-wall floor mat. When paired with these wall-hung shoe storage boxes, it really helps to maximize the space, and if they are any deeper, I'll be walking into them all the time. With the coat and key racks finishing off this space, and the total cost of everything in this room, from the floor mat, the shoe storage, and the coat rack was just £121. Not a bad start for this budget build, which I gave myself around £8,500 for. Now, as we take the long walk into the bathroom, it's worth mentioning that there was no running water in this building at all when the renovation started, so that was a significant extra cost.
Now, of course, this is a small bathroom, but the shower feels incredibly spacious, and this wall was actually moved back in order to achieve this,
which allows for a much more relaxing shower for someone as tall as me, and much more legroom when using the loo. The cost of this room was just over £1,100 in materials and £4,000 in labour, for a total of £5,124, which is where the majority of the budget for this entire renovation went. But you may have noticed there's no sink, which means washing your hands in the kitchen. A small space calls for a small kitchen, and that's exactly what I've done here. But despite that, there's still plenty of room to store, prep, and cook food at home. There's no oven in here, but I rarely use one anyway. And this four-burner cooktop is more than enough to cook all of my meals. And the microwave is great for reheating any leftovers. The angled extractor fan is compact, which allows me to see what I'm cooking, whilst the smaller fridge allows room on top and down the side to store more things. Now, I think upgrading this toaster to an air fryer would be a huge upgrade for this kitchen, but I want to know what you think, so let me know in the comments below what you think would be the biggest upgrade to this kitchen. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention that these two walls are magnetic whiteboards, which I use all the time to make notes, plan my days, and make lists of things I need to do. To heat the space, I use this electric radiator, because I didn't want to run any gas lines into the property, as that would have massively increased cost. As for keeping it cool, I just have to open the window and the door and the place will cool down within minutes. The cost of this kitchen is a little more complicated because I had the worked up and splashback already from a different project. I also got a few things from Facebook Marketplace to help keep the cost down, such as the cooktop, extractor fan and even the tap. In total though, it cost me just under £1,300, and if you added a little bit more for the bits I got for free, you could look to spend around £1,700 in order to achieve a similar look. Finishing off the kitchen, I have this floor-to-ceiling cupboard, which stores the majority of my possessions. Paring down from a three-bed house to a seven-shelf cupboard did take some time, but it was something I was going to need to do anyway before the end of the year when I move away. And now we get to where I spend most of my days, the office. I wanted this area to feel more luxurious and professional, as I knew I'd be spending the majority of my time here as a software engineer during the day and a wannabe YouTuber at night. So that's why I chose to make the desk out of a piece of solid oak from an old dining table which I found on Facebook Marketplace, which, when combined with the sit-stand desk frame, gives a lot of flexibility when working. The dual monitors are mounted to this stand, which looks much cleaner than just keeping them both on the desk, and more importantly, it provides a lot more space for everything else. This space will be getting even cleaner soon too, as this PC has just been replaced by my new personal laptop, which is a significant upgrade over my 12-year-old PC. And the reason I could afford this upgrade is because of you. By watching my previous video and subscribing, I managed to unlock monetization. And with that first video payslip, I upgraded my setup in order to make better videos. So if you have enjoyed this video so far, please consider subscribing, pressing the bell icon, and why not like the video while you're down there too. It's really helping the channel a lot in these early days. Thank you. As for the cost of everything in this office, I spent just £301. Now, I know what a lot of you are thinking. Why did I use such a dark color in this tiny space? And look, I get it. This was the first space I ever designed myself from start to finish, and I learned a lot about interior design along the way. However, even after living in here for 6 months, I still absolutely love this blue. It may not be for everybody, but for me, it works, and it's never made the space feel claustrophobic at all. If I'm not out and about, this is where I spend most of my evenings. And whilst I don't use the sofa in this mode too much, when it's set up as a recliner, it becomes a perfect hangout space for relaxing, playing games, and watching TV. Speaking of, I have this 49-inch LG TV mounted to the wall, which may seem like it's at a terrible viewing angle, but it is actually on this extendable mount, so the entire TV pulls out and rotates 90 degrees, so that you can see it while sitting on the sofa. In fact, you can rotate this TV any way you like. You can watch TV whilst cooking, washing up, or even on the toilet. The wall-mounted PS4 behind the TV ensured that minimal space was used, whilst allowing me to be always just a click of a button away from jumping into some games. To transform this space into a bedroom, I simply have to pull out the sofa, set up the legs, and lay the back on the floor. This gives me about a small double bed in total. I fit. Right? So how much did this all cost? Well, I came into this with a budget of £8,500, and looking back at the kitchen, bathroom, and everything else we've seen so far, they all came to a total of just under £6,700. And when you add in the near £1,200 for the living room section, the total so far comes to £7,870. And that leaves just the miscellaneous section, which includes things like the fencing, electrics, and anything else that didn't naturally fit into any of the other categories. And in total, that came to just under £2,400, leading to a grand total of £10,241. I'll admit it's a little bit over budget, but by doing the work myself, I helped keep that cost from getting even more out of control. So that leaves one more question. Was it worth it? Well, I've actually lived here now for 6 months, and I'm really enjoying being in this space. But besides being just somewhere for me to live whilst the house gets renovated, I actually had the whole house evaluated before and after I did this renovation, and the number surprised me. For what cost me £10,000 to renovate, it added £30,000 of value to the house, which was far more than I ever expected. I thought maybe I'd get the money that I invested into it back, but to see that it tripled my investment blew my mind. There are some links in the description below to a lot of the products you've seen throughout this video. And if you want to actually see me transform this space from start to finish, then click right here or here to see that video, because not everything went to plan. And with that, please consider liking the video, subscribing to the channel if you're new around here, and I will see you next time.
I want to see if it's possible to eat healthy for $1 a day for a full week. I've shared my plans to do this with a few people, and I always get the reaction, why? So here's a very quick explanation, and I'll go more in depth a little bit later on in this video. There are a few reasons. One, I'm very inspired by the resourcefulness of Mexicans and their creativity with such limited resources. Two, it's a common Stoic practice to experiment with less and to remind yourself how little you really need to be happy in life. And three, I've noticed a little bit of lifestyle creep. I seem to be spending more money every single month, and that's a kind of alarming idea because the way I see things, I'm not happy.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing. Right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself. Right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right, and you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food, they are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you, and that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? Where, like, there are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value. right? And there's things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? So, but I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs, and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means, like, they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay, judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian. Like it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17. Why? The answer was always going to be the same, because I said so. Right. So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but, like, you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay, because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from, Second place values come from is present, pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got to value. I want to win. So what? Because I want to win. Okay. For instance, I'm gonna put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time. And he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town. And then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again, and so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one is future pursued, I think I spelled that right, I don't know. Pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you a for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter, who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay, she'll be 4 in July. So that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be, oh snap, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me, as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking. Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning, and I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake. Then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch, and I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So that's but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, look at him. It's really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you what I'm willing, my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? It's too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future, right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about, sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids or how to win their present pursued victories or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all tracking? Okay? So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. But or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1. And I call it the four levels of value. So because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is, either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why. Like, if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like, it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So, like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for, like, seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one, but I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son, my son-in-law, we can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then, when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many y'all tracking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer, and you make an offer to that person, and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high-pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what we have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who's limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people, now, if you just love like mowing grass and you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification, on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe, if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make, oops, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that, how many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by, I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell. They're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership, or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is, if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so, like, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication. On the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication. Okay? So communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity, right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it, right? Okay. Well, so communication. On this level, low end, you should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance, right? Selling advertising, $100,000 a year. But on the high end, you might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Like, our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once. Just get paid for them every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of... I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book? Anybody could. Who will write a book? Almost no one. Okay, so, these people are coaches and teachers. And actors, and songwriters, and playwrights, right? Please don't let me forget this one. And YouTubers, crazy town. YouTube. Don't even get me started on YouTube, y'all. I might not be able to get off of it. Like, YouTube? Like, I had no idea. I've been on YouTube since 2007. I didn't even know there was a thing called turning on monetization until 2022. How many years is that? 15. I think it's 15. Ain't that 15? 15 years. I was on YouTube for 15 years. I didn't know all I had to do was click a button. They start paying me. Click a button. Like, just how long it takes to click a button. Click. Get paid. I mean, I wasn't creating new videos. I had like 40 videos on. We turned on monetization, did no new videos. The first month, didn't do any new videos, hadn't done any new videos in like 8 months, turned on.
Okay, today, well, playing that prematurely. Today, our live stream title is, an asset per day will keep the bill collector away. We've all heard of the expression, an apple a day, eat an apple a day to keep the doctor away. That's for your wellness. That might work. I think it does work when you got, well, anyway, try it out. But today we're talking about an asset a day will keep the bill collector away, income-producing asset. So we're going to play this audio real quick. We played this here before. It's not long, about 4 minutes long, and then we'll make the announcement based on the audio we're playing right now.
Imagine living in a space that measures a mere 168 square feet, more than 14 times smaller than the average American home. Well, it is here inside this tiny house where the proud owners are discovering that less is so much more.
Well, in the past year, we've managed to save everything that I earn. We use my husband's income for our living expenses, and I've been teaching public school, so that's about $3,000 a month that we've put in the bank this year.
Hari, her husband Carl, and their two young kids, Archer and Ella, recently celebrated their one-year anniversary in their tiny house. After losing their 1,500-square-foot home to financial struggles, the couple took matters into their own hands, literally. They built this space themselves with just $13,000 in materials. Their goal? To become debt-free and save enough to one day build a new home, mortgage-free. And so far, they're right on track.
Things are going really well with the next project. We're going to build a 16 by 24 unit to begin with, and then we'll branch off of that and add bedrooms.
You may remember seeing this family on The Anderson Show earlier this year, where I joined them on stage. Fascinated by their story, our financially fit team flew down to Virginia to see for ourselves and learn ways we can all downsize.
How are you?
Hey,
really good.
Thank you. Hey there.
Living in the tiny house has taught me that we don't need much at all to be happy, and that getting the things that we need can actually be a lot of fun.
Can you get me a bowl and some scissors?
The family's fruit and vegetable garden lets them eat healthier, cut down on their carbon footprint, and slash their grocery bill by as much as 30%. Hari has also been upcycling, as she calls it, taking something old and breathing new life into it.
My favorite upcycling project was the rugs I made for the house. I took old sheets, flat sheets, and crocheted them into rugs. They're beautiful, and they fit the house a lot nicer than if we had gone and bought something new from the store.
The couple also recently switched jobs, not for more money, but more happiness. Carl is enjoying better working conditions at a new restaurant, and Hari left teaching to pursue a career in nonprofit. Being able to afford a career that you love and pursuing a passion rather than a paycheck, they've learned, is just an added benefit to having savings and no debt.
I'm probably taking a 25 to 30% cut in my salary, which is going to enable me to have more time to actually build the house and save money because I'll be the contractor.
It's really a great feeling to be able to make a decision like that, not based on money, but based on what we want to be doing with our time.
The kids also seem keen to the transition. Mom and Dad are happy to report fewer requests for video games or toys now that Ella and Archer are busy playing outdoors on their 3-acre property.
We play down by the creek and up at the big tree up there where the swing is. We play with our neighbors and ride bikes.
And there's a lot of different things they can do with their time besides play with plastic toys and get online.
They've really just embraced it wholeheartedly. You can't stop them from having a good time outside.
Still another lesson, when you downsize, it helps to have a support system.
There's such a wealth of knowledge in our community, and that helps us a lot. And having that support makes it like we're doing it together. Moving to the country has given us a lot of things, not just the tiny house.
So, what do you think? What are your thoughts about living in a tiny house? Would you ever do it? Connect with me on Twitter at Farnoosh and use the hashtag FinFit for Yahoo Finance. I'm Farnoosh Tarabi.
Okay, today we're talking about an asset that will keep the bill collector away. Now, we got a major announcement that's tied into this audio that we just passed. If you want to see the visual of that, the audio visual of that, you can go to our Facebook page, which is BRY Shacks. B as in boy, I as in ideal, Y as in yourself, which stands for Build It Yourself Shacks. That's our Facebook page, BRY Shacks at Earthwell Forest. That's up, and then it's the first video that you'll see. And that tiny house, four people and I'm trying to get the footprint, a picture of the footprint and put it online. Let me work on that. We're going to listen to Solar Cab and then we're going to go to make the announcement. We'll make the announcement within about the next seven minutes and 50 seconds. So we're going to listen to Solar Cab while we do that and then go straight to the phone lines.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean, it's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Okay, now I've posted on our Facebook page, which is BIY, That means build it yourself shacks. Not this audio, but the audio before on the Tiny House family. And the Tiny House family at the time, just for the people that are tuning in, let's see. They had to downsize out of the home that they foreclosed on or whatever. It was over 1,000 square feet, whatever it was. But they downsized four people into 168 square feet. Now, for the last couple of weeks, last half month or so, I've been studying housing on a global level. And although a lot of you think a tiny house, let me preface it this way. A lot of people that might be listening to this program that might be living in what is considered a developed country or a Western country might consider 168 square feet or 400 square feet as a tiny house. But in my research for the last couple of weeks or so, I've been putting in about 4 or 5 hours a day on this minimum. If we go around the globe, because there are more people in so-called undeveloped nations than developed nations. I think they actually should be switched around, but that's another podcast. But the sweet spot for a lot of people that live around the world, I would say half the planet, out of 8 billion people on the planet, the sweet spot for many people, including many families, households around the globe, is about 96 to 100 square feet. Now, at the beginning of this podcast, I played an interview that Oprah did in India several years ago, where she visited with a family in Mumbai, India, and they lived in a 100-square-foot apartment. All right, so if you're living in a westernized country right now, the United States, UK, Germany, someplace like that, Poland, more than likely you're living, and you're struggling, more than likely you're living in a place that you really can't afford or it's too big for you to maintain, and you've taken out a loan for the next 30 years or whatever you got. Because I'm talking about half of this planet that does have housing, they have no mortgages. All right. Now, based on that and audios I played today is, and that's why I call this an asset per day, will keep the bill collector away. And I said when I mean asset, income reducing asset. In the United States, you have a little bit over 3,000 counties. You might have 3,100 counties in the United States. And there's at least two people that are looking for in each one of those counties. And now these are super conservative numbers. You have at least two people. One person's looking for something to make some money with. The other person is looking for a roof to get over their head, something that they can afford to live in. I prefer to call it budget housing. So what we're doing, what we're launching this week is, and we're going to test market it, beta test it under two names, Home by 7 or Home by 8, meaning from scratch, we're going to take 7 people in a particular geographical market in one of those 3,000 counties in the United States. Take 7 people in that particular county, and within 8 hours, we would have built one tiny house being probably no larger than 168 square feet. It'll be anywhere from 96 to no more than 168 square feet, which the tiny house family, they're right here in the United States. They're in the state of Virginia now. Now, they bought 3 acres of land, and they built the large, because, you know, what a growing family. But still, they're debt-free. So once again, we'll be beta testing under the marketing terms of titles of Home by 7. In other words, what time is it right now? I'm on the East Coast of the United States. So it's 11:50 a.m. So let's just push it on up 10 minutes from now, 12 noon. So if we start building at 12 noon, by 7 or 8, the house will be built from scratch and in move-in condition. That's our directive for this year. One a day, starting this week. More details on that tomorrow. Let's see, phone lines 309. Your mic is open.
Good morning, LA.
Good morning.
Thank you for being in that room this morning, and I definitely shared the link in the room, and I think we got people that are listening that might have called in. And if we do, you know, I'd like to unmic them and get their
press one, and we'll open your mic.
And one of the things is, you know, it was I had a remark to someone I knew that was listening that we should put this on Zoom. So we do our podcast, but put it on Zoom so that way we can show them what they're hearing. So that solar cabin right. video could be playing on the screen. And we could get
That sounds good, yeah.
You know, on some huge platforms to really get some interaction and get some action, right? That's what this is about. And I love the fact that,
right.
you know, you make that announcement to start building a house and – we're going to video it, you know, that's the beautiful thing, right? You didn't mention that yet, but, you know, video it, do the live feed, and people can actually see it, order it, order something else, but get engaged.
Right, and so like I say, here in the United States, we got a little bit, I think 3,100 counties or county equivalents in the United States. So the market is there. So we're basically going to use basically as we build it, we can do it on, one of the platforms is Facebook Live. And like I say, it's within we have our formula is 781, which means organize 7 people, and within 8 hours, we would have built a tiny house. That's what we mean by home by 7 to home by 8, moving condition, within that time frame. 7 people within 8 hours, one house, and that the dimensions, 96 square feet to no more than 168 square feet, but in moving condition. That's the goal. And once we got a couple of, you know, just that's something that we can do on a daily basis. So anybody interested, we'll how to get in contact with us and how to participate. We already got a core group, which we call the Original Four. So we got them. That's our first group. But in any event, like I say, I think that's a doable deal. You know, 96 square feet, that's not a whole lot, or up to 168 square feet. And these will be all off-the-grid homes. Now, for those of you that are not familiar with off-the-grid, what that means, at least what we're talking about, off-the-grid means you're not plugged into any municipal power at all. No municipal water, no municipal electricity. No private company, which ultimately means you have no utility bills. You can have your flat screen TV. You can charge your phones. You can heat your home. You can have plenty of fresh water, but it's not. But it doesn't come from any municipal or government source or any private monopolized utility company. Because you got, for all practical purposes, many of the utility companies in the United States are monopolies. But so you know, you get your modern conveniences, internet, and all that, but no electric bill coming into you every month, no water bill coming in every month. Now, for your heat, depending on what part of the country that you're in, you'll probably, well, if you use biofuels, because our homes will be heated with biofuels. What are biofuels? Biofuels are things like wood, anything that burns from nature. Corn, you got people that have corn stoves. So your corn bill or your wood bill will be like super small. So, well, and we're going to have to educate people on basically how to live off the grid, because most people have been tied in psychologically to the grid, and they don't know how to live a sustainable lifestyle without plugged into somebody else. But these homes generate their own power. So when we say off the grid, these homes generate their own power with solar and wind and your own independent source of water. Let's see, we do have another caller here. So anyway, home by seven, home by eight. So like I said, we start building at 12 by seven is eight. They're built, ready to move into. 323, your mic is open.
323-816-5100. Just want to say I appreciate you. And I'm Brian Bam Franklin out of Los Angeles, California, the homeless capital of the United States of America. I'm on Skid Row at least once a week working to create solutions. And I appreciate the works that you are doing. And I share with virtually everyone that I come in contact with regarding collaboration. And there's a lot of people that are recommending tiny house builds. And we like what Chris is doing. How does what Chris does for build-outs work in conjunction with what you're recommending for build-outs? That's my question. I'm done speaking. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that me and Chris are collaborating on is our tiny house. That's all me and him talk about, our tiny houses, because he does, you know, with the metal framing of it. Now, the distinction that I make is, let me give some background on myself. I've been a landlord since 1983, started in Washington, D.C., still have property in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is on the grid. Los Angeles, California is on the grid. So part of the, in my opinion, I'm just basing it on my opinion and my experiences over the years of stuff on the grid, it's in a city like D.C., New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington, those places, Dallas, San Antonio, Miami, Florida, Orlando, those places. Those are like heavily grid-tied cities. One of the reasons, or some of the reasons, that you might have a homeless problem or eviction problem or something like that is because those are expensive cities to operate on. And in my opinion, a lot of them are over-regulated. So there's certain things, like, for instance, I'm in Polk County, Florida. It's got about maybe 100,000 people that live here now. But 30 years ago, it was like under 75,000 people. So where I'm living at right now, and along with my neighbors, we all have independent sources of water. We're not tied into the municipal water system. Whereas in a place like Los Angeles, or Washington, D.C., you can't dig with your own, have your own independent water system consisting of groundwater, also known as well water. So now you might be able to do that in Los Angeles County, further out where there's smaller towns. But in the city of Los Angeles or your larger municipalities out there, you can't do that. So we tell people that if you want to reduce your cost of living as far as your household goes, because where we'll be building is all rural areas. And some of these rural areas might be 15 to 20 minutes outside of a municipality. Other areas, you might have to go further out. So we tell people, look at if, for instance, a lot of people who are homeless right now, it's really a matter of geography. If they would just move 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or maybe in some cases an hour away, they can find an affordable house to live in. And I'll give you some examples. In Muskogee County, Oklahoma, let me look up the population of Muskogee, Oklahoma. Okay, Muskogee, Oklahoma, which is about 45 minutes. Let's see. It's not that far from Tulsa. All right, Muskogee, Oklahoma has a population of 36,790 people. All right, which is, depending on where you, if you're in Los Angeles, that's a subdivision. Okay, but for a lot of people around the country, it's a small town. But in Muskogee, you got everything you need. I mean, T-Mobile, they got Walmart, all the basics they have in Muskogee, population under 40,000 people. All right. Now, Muskogee is what I would call on the grid. However, if you drive 15 minutes in any kind of direction, a 15-minute radius around Muskogee, like Taft, Oklahoma, Summit, Oklahoma, those places, then you can find a piece of property where you can build your home or rent a home or buy a home that's totally off the grid if you want to be off the grid as far as utility bills or whatever. Now, let's say you don't want to you want to live in a larger town. Well, and like Taft, Oklahoma might have a population of about 350 people. All right. So 45 minutes away is Tulsa, Oklahoma. And you've got, it's a bigger city, more people, more density. You know, some people just need to be in a crowded place or whatever. It doesn't have a million people at it, but still. So we tell people, like, the way I see it, homelessness, now I'm taking away some things like mental illness. All right. But if you're physically able-bodied, of sound mind, but you're living in a place like L.A., Seattle, Washington, and Seattle, Washington, the average selling price of a home is like $1 million in that city. All right. But if you go, like, say, depending on the city, the metro area, and there are 108,000 towns in the United States, only 10 or 11 of them have a population of a million or more people. So a person can actually go from homelessness or struggling to prosperity if they would just move their geography as little as 15 to 20 minutes. Now, in some cases, that might be 60 minutes away, which is an hour's drive. In other cases, it might be 90 miles away. That's an hour and a half. And there are people that work in L.A., and they have a three-hour commute to L.A. every day because they make their paycheck in Los Angeles or Silicon Valley, but they live by commute 3 hours away. So you have that, you know, that's the same thing. You got people that live in, that work in D.C. There are more people that work in D.C., but they live somewhere else. So a lot of it has to do with geography. So that's one of the things we tell people. Check your geography unless you can find a friend. Now, in Los Angeles or what do you call it, let's say Seattle, Washington, you can build a tiny house. They have they have ordinances on the book with zoning called ADU, accessory dwelling units. But at least in Seattle, you might drop $100,000 to $200,000 to build that tiny house in your already existing house in the backyard. Whereas I'm saying, no, no, no. Go look at a rural area and you know, drop your costs down to the figures that you've been hearing on this podcast that I play on here every day. And let me give you a visual on this. And I'm going to have to get some artists to help me do this. But let me give you an audio visual of this. Just visualize a chessboard. A chessboard has 67 squares. All right. 86% of the population of the United States of America lives or occupies 3% of a total land mass. I'll repeat that again. And there's over 330 million people in the United States. But 86% of that figure of 330 million people occupy only 3% of the available land mass. On a chessboard, I believe that's two squares. Or no, that's a square and a half. During this presidential election year, and you can check the record on this one, or notice it this year, no president that's running for office will visit all 50 states. They don't need to. The population areas that they will visit is the 95 corridor from Richmond, Virginia, up to Boston, the Inland Empire in the Los Angeles metro area in California, up in the Bay Area, Seattle, Washington, the Cascades, the Golden Triangle of Texas. That's the triangle between San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Houston. There are more people that live in that Golden Triangle of Texas. Once again, San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth area, they're taking the triangle down to Houston, Texas, that live in the entire state of Georgia and a couple other places. That's it. No presidential candidate visits all 50 states. They go to the most densely populated regions or metro areas of the United States. That's it. So now the remainder of the 97% of the United States, which is about, what, 14% that's left out of 86% out of 100 total, they live in the rural areas in the United States. If you want to go from the poorhouse to a wealthier house, go to the country. It's as simple as that. However, in Western culture, most Westerners, including us Americans, most, not all, are addicted to the comfort and conveniences of city life. And most of us can't afford it. And your politicians are not going to come at you like that. They're not going to tell you that.
You know, I was going to add.
Anyway, Chris, I'm turning it back over to you.
I was going to say for one other thing that Bam, you know, as he asked there, I wanted to throw something back at L.A. that he's right there. So we need to figure out how we can reach the people that own houses in L.A. and we can get a $40,000 credit toward building them an ADU in their backyard. they can pay the difference, or we can build it complete where it doesn't cost them anything. And what we would like to do is figure out maybe, you know, several different options of we occupy it, you know, we lease it from them, and work with the programs that you and all the other collaboratives can actually get to for housing and do a mass movement. But the money is there for $40,000 per house to be built in any backyard in LA and in California, period. So I wanted to throw that out there to you, Brian, and say we, you know, I think that would be a huge influx to answering our problems, and we can involve it with the, you know, 781, you know, 7 people, 8 hours, 1 house.
Is my mic still open?
Yes,
yes.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, final comment. I live in a very unique space from a mental perspective of collaboration. We have so many entities that are building ADUs now. The one who's advertising the most is getting the most of the business. How do we scale our desires to make a difference in the major cities? And so ADUs and APs, but there's so many companies doing it. How do we get what Chris is doing? That's why I asked that question. I think you said your name is LA, is that correct?
Yeah, LA, yeah.
Okay. I had asked the question, what are you all doing that's collaborative? Because we are, I'm going to use this term, close to dominating in regards to what we do in regards to the four items that we consider to be the four top reasons for homelessness nationwide. One, mental health, which you talked about, LA. Two, cash flow, because if you can't afford it, you can't live there. Three, affordable housing. Four, nonprofit individualism. We have over a million nonprofits that are, quote unquote, addressing an issue. That's part of the statute of a nonprofit. What problem are you solving? Okay, you get your tax credit for whoop de whoop de whoop. So it's like on the cash flow piece, looking at the data, it sounds like you, oh, I know Chris is a data guy. It sounds like you are also, LA. LA, today, and it will change in the next week or two or three, but today, the richest man in the world, according to Forbes, is Jeff Bezos of Amazon. 2 weeks ago, it was Bernard Arnault of Louis Vuitton, Hennessy, luxury items. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 months ago, it was Elon Musk. So the top three guys keep jostling. So where I'm going with that, the piece that we have and we control, we're 25 years old. We're not new to our game of e-commerce. Not only are we deep in e-commerce at the highest level, we actually have intellectual property tied to what it is that we do. It's called .eco. For our purposes, it's for e-commerce. And so we are working to get the nonprofits to collaborate on the e-commerce piece based on the richest man in the world today. Amazon had a nonprofit give-back model called Amazon Smile. They shut it down, and here's what they said. This is a public press release. We're shutting down Amazon Smile because we have too many nonprofits. We're spread too thin. Of the million nonprofits, like your chessboard analogy, their average disbursement, LA and Chris, and others that may be listening, $230 a year. Take $230 a year times a million. You can put out a press release as Amazon, big Amazon. We've given over $230 million away. So for the sleep and the non-woke people, man, that's so much money. I want some. We can't solve the problem individually. We've got to have entities that are coming together. 10 million, last thing I'm going to say, 10 men have more money than half the people in the world. And of the 10, 7 or 8 of them are in technology. So we can solve some of these challenges. However, it's got to have a collaborative piece. It's got to be, let's look at these top 10. How do we tap into any one of the 10? So that's where I live, and I'm going to run. And I made the suggestion because that video you were running sounds great. I'm a technologist, L.A., at the highest level. I've been in technology since 1984, working in the technology sector. I was at my trade school in 83. The personal computer was introduced in 82. The YouTube recommendation is a more effective than a Facebook Live, by the way. And the reason is the world, per se, went to Zoom post-2020. The social environment with Facebook, it's a virtual waste of time with all due respect. And last thing I'm going to share, I was part of a think tank at a university called the California African American Political and Economic Institute. Joined the institute in 2007. Being a technologist, the PhDs, I was one of the few in the think tank that did not have a PhD. They asked me to do a report in 2007 on social media. One would think the report would be pages after pages after pages. The report then was one sentence. The report today is the same one sentence. And that one sentence is, social media is a virtual waste of time. Threads proved it. When Threads launched, all these people ran to Threads. 30 days later, you don't even hear about Threads anymore. So I'm going to land my plane there. Would love to collaborate with you. And through Chris, and Chris will be, I'm getting ready to watch the video that Chris popped in the room we had on Clubhouse. But I'm going to recommend, LA, in regard to the technology you're using, is use more, I'm going to use this term respectfully, newer technology. Blog Talk, it's not the place because you can't interact with you. We can talk. We need to do more. Sometimes you need to see me. Sometimes I need to send you a link. Sometimes with that link, I have something I want you to do. So the Blog Talk environment doesn't allow that. So just keep that in mind. And I'm going to stay here for another, 7 minutes, 25, I'm going to run, but I'll be here for 7 and long. I gave a lot of data there, so we just would love to hear your response. But again, 25 after, I'm going to have to run. Appreciate you all. I'm done.
Okay, well, that was good feedback that you gave. Reason why I use Blog Talk, and I've been on Blog Talk for a little bit over 10 years now. We got over 2,500, basically networking. I've had mayors of, let me give the backstory of this podcast. The current name that we go by here is DIY Shacks, which means build it yourself shacks, shacks representing housing. The original name when we started a little bit over 10 years ago was It's My House. Now, where did that name come from? I have a house to this day in Washington, D.C., where I had a house sitter that I was trying to get out of the house because I was, you know, back and forth between D.C. and Europe at the time. I lived in Europe for about 6 months out of the year. So after, I don't know, about 3, 4, 5 years, whatever, I said, I need the house back. Okay. And this person, I guess I let him stay in there too long because they were just, all they didn't have to pay me any rent. They were just house sitters. So long story short, they tried to take the house. So when I would even send repair people over, they would say, wouldn't even let the repair people in. They would say, it's not his house, it's my house. So that's how we came up with the podcast name, It's My House. And it started out this podcast on basically how to protect from house getting taken over by squatters and things of that nature. Now, One of the as a networking platform, which I still use it as a networking platform to meet people, is in D.C. I tried to organize a political group to get some laws changed on the books that if somebody is squatting in your house, which legally on the books in black letter law, that's trespassing. You should be able to get that person out of the house. So I tried to get some landlords together, but I couldn't get any cooperation. So I said, you know what, let me switch up and get something in the rural area. And then when I got into a rural area, I found out it's dramatically less, like, for instance, I got my first 4 acres, I bought for $24,000. My tax bill on them for this year, if I pay it late, is $258 for the whole year on 4 acres. That's like 4 football fields. So I said, I'll switch to that. Then I started interviewing, because if you want to go tiny, the easiest place to go tiny is to find a county, a small county, or a tiny county with a tiny population, and then look for towns that have a tiny population. So I started, I found, for instance, and some of you long-time listeners, when I go to certain cities and towns that have a population of 400 people or less, the mayor picks me up at the airport. So I found that I can gain more on an individual and business level if I deal with small, tiny towns. So I use this platform where we've had mayors on. They're not mayors of New York City, but they're mayors on of Bossier, Alabama, Taft, Oklahoma, Tallahassee, Oklahoma, little Tuskegee, Alabama. So they're mayors of small towns, but they're mayors of small towns that they'll pick you up at the airport, and you can get your 40 acres if you want 40 acres. Now, a year ago, we interviewed, and this is why I use Blog Talk, because I can talk to people just like you or anybody else one-on-one and develop relationships that way. Three black women out of metro Atlanta, they ran across 97 acres of land. And then they started doing tours from Atlanta, where they have no political power, to this 97 acres, and they got 19 families together, and they're called the Freedom Georgia Initiative, and now they're up to 502 acres, so they're doing their own town. So that's the universe that I'm in, and that's why I use Blog Talk for the last 10 years and running. I do it 5 days a week. That's not the only platform we use. It's just one of the platforms we use. Now, when we start building on a daily basis, we'll be using Zoom, you know, because people have their preferences. You know, people like Zoom, people like Facebook Marketplace, some people like eBay. Yeah, I mean, for instance, eBay. A lot of people might not use eBay. But I got I bought 10 acres of land in Texas on eBay for $2,000, debt-free. And that came from that video, not that audio and video I played earlier today called Solar Cabin. That's how I heard it. So I use Blog Talk essentially as a platform. It's my business card. It's not my only business card, but it's just one of my business cards. So, I mean, I've interviewed the son of Marva Collins, Candy Lightner, the lady who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving. So on Blog Talk, it's intimate. It's my personal business card. And like I said, we got over 2,500 shows archived. But it's not my only platform I use. We also use Twitter, Clubhouse on occasion. We do terrestrial radio. We did that last fall. Because some things you just can't. And you know what? Here's my opinion about the virtual world exists, but behind every person who's sitting behind a computer, a smartphone, I'm sitting behind a laptop. I got a laptop in my lap, and I'm on a smartphone right now. I'm in the virtual world talking to people. but I'm all housed on brick and mortar on 3/4 acre of land. We all live in a brick and mortar world. Now, there's a lot of ways we can market to each other, but I think you got to take a look at all of it. And my metrics are probably different from the average person. You mentioned Jeff Bezos and whoever else is a well-known person if you read the Forbes 400. I measure wealth differently. My number one metric for wealth is natural resources. There's not a person on this planet, virtual world or no virtual world, that doesn't need water, that doesn't need something that comes from the earth. The clothes, the food, you name it, it's coming from the earth. So my number one wealth metric is natural resources. And I like to follow the wealthiest landowners in the world. And I start calling out names. People wouldn't even know who most of them are. The second wealth metric I have is what I call social capital, because you can have $1 trillion in the bank, but if you're on a desert island or in the desert and you don't have a community around you, you can't do anything. Or if you if you're in a community where you're limited, you can't do much. But that's another reason why we have 781. Seven people, we can remember seven names. 700 people, you really can't remember 700 names. Or you can't have 700 relationships. You know, I'd rather have an intimate group of 10 to 12 people and everybody knows their names, whereas on, what do you call it, YouTube, you got a person who's got 1 million subscribers. Because if you ask that person, name 10 people out of those 1 million subscribers, they probably can't name 10 people. And then how many people have they met and broke bread out of that 1 million subscribers? Whereas, except for the exception of two mayors that I've had on this program over the years, I've sat down and broken bread with each and every one of those mayors. They're in little tiny towns, but once again, with the little tiny towns, I don't have to worry about pulling permits, because in some of these towns, you don't need to pull a permit to build a house. So that's the world I live in. In any event, we'll have more information tomorrow on Home by 7 or Home by 8. We're going to beta test under both of those. Once again, the idea of that is using 781, seven people. And basically, we're not doing anything new. It's the Amish and the Mennonite and the Hutterites have been doing this for forever. And even before them, people have been doing it. So 781, seven people within 8 hours built one house that's anywhere from 96 square feet to no more than 168 square feet. You know? Something within, it'll be in moving condition. Nothing sexy, but it'll be the needed shelter that individual household, that's what they want, because they're going to be participating in building it themselves. Chris, any other comments for today? All right, Chris could have stepped away. All right, so asset per day, that's our goal. And you can do this on an individual basis, whatever your preference of assets are. We've had people on here that their asset is cupcakes. Mignon Francois, originally out of New Orleans, Louisiana. She was losing her house to foreclosure. Seven or eight kids? And she turned her grandmother's recipe for cupcakes into a multi-million-dollar business. Now she started in New Orleans, but now she's also in Nashville, Tennessee. So her asset are cupcakes. So everybody's got a different income-producing asset. Chris, you back?
Yes, I am.
Okay, yeah, so here. any comments to close us out for today?
No. Just look forward to tomorrow's show and watching the week start to grow and watch one of these things go up and do a video so other people can see. So I'm just grateful to be part of it and see we know that tiny villages are going up all over the country. We know they're there. People are talking about them in L.A. or everywhere. They're talking about them everywhere. And we just need to implement, let people see it so that we can help them grow quick and build easy.
And you know
what,
this week, by the end of the month, we're going to go back to how some of these big towns became big towns, because Los Angeles, matter of fact, let me do it while I'm on air right now. I have a saying that I see on here occasionally, everything starts with one. So let's look at Los Angeles. Wikipedia, which is my favorite. Because Houston, Texas, which has, over a million people, it started with two people, two brothers. Miami, Florida, started with one woman. And a lot of towns started, they just start off with, little small families. So let's see, Los Angeles, let's look at the history of it. Once again, that's the way I tangle. When you go small, you can scale quicker. And there's less people, less politics. So it's Los Angeles. Where's the Wikipedia on this? Los Angeles. Wikipedia. Like Everett Washington, which is outside of Seattle, Washington, that started with one guy. Let's see. One guy and an axe. He was a carpenter. Okay, Los Angeles. Okay, I don't want greater Los Angeles. Los Angeles. Okay, we want to go to the history of Los Angeles. We want the very beginning. History was first settled by a small group of Native Americans centuries before the first European contact in 1769. So the history goes back as far as 1769. All right, Los Angeles, as we know it today, was founded in 1781. While the area was still within the borders of the Viceroy of New Spain, the area had been early explored by two Franciscan priests named Jenny Pereiro Sierra and Juan Crispy. And following the Mexican Independent War, the region passed into the hands of Mexico, depending on how you want to look at this, the origins of Los Angeles, we can go back to 1769 with a small group of Native Americans. They don't put the number, but small group, that's what they have in Wikipedia. Then, when Europeans came along, there were just two of them. All right, now Los Angeles has a population of3,898,747 people. That's the people that live in Los Angeles. So take your pick. It started with a small group of Native Americans. But if you want to date it from European, it started with two Europeans. Take your pick, either one. But so I prefer to go the Freedom Georgia route and they're recent, and we had, they're in our archives here on Blog Talk. It started with three women, and they went and got 19 families. Chris, you've talked to them, haven't you? If Chris is here. And you don't have the politics, you don't have the bureaucracy, whatever. Like I say, there are 108,000 towns in the United States. If you want to find a sense of, if you want to find the real United States, go see out the small towns. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.